Welcome to Bible Study for Progressives, a show where moderates, liberals, and leftists of all faiths and ideologies come together to discuss scripture, spirituality, and politics. We engage scripture in its historical context, plumb its depths for wisdom and guidance, and apply its lessons to current events and social issues. Whether you're a liberal evangelical, a New Age spiritualist, a social justice activist, or a postmodern theologian, there's something in this show for you. Come, be energized in spirit and mind to understand the word and what it means to be a spiritual person in today's world. What happened on January 6th is that we almost lost what little democracy we have left, and we almost descended into a dictatorship under the rule of a tyrant. It's important to recognize this. Had Trump prevailed, we would no longer have a democracy. We would be a nation led by a sociopath like North Korea, China, and Russia. Trump ignored the rulings of the courts, rejected the democratically elected legislators who certified the results, and then incited thousands to attack the Capitol in a violent and reckless attempt to hold on to power. He and his confederates incited the insurrection with a campaign of disinformation and explicit calls for violence, all in service to a doomed plan to overthrow our democracy by force and violence. If we do not deter this type of behavior, the insurrectionists will be back, better organized and led, and sooner than we think. The forces of authoritarianism will return as soon as it becomes clear that we do not have the political will to prosecute our leaders. We must find a way to hold our leaders accountable, or they will continue to disseminate disinformation and undermine democracy. We cannot expect to have a working system of justice if we allow our leaders to commit federal crimes without consequence. Systemic injustice is at the center of our agenda. Defending the Constitution and fighting for democracy are progressive causes. We are still in coup prevention mode. We won the battle, but not the war. Democracy is still threatened here at home and around the globe. In fact, democracy is collapsing worldwide. The protests we see around the world are not socialist revolutions. They are pro-democracy movements. Even now, pro-democracy activists are fighting back, but they are being suppressed by authoritarian regimes and dictators everywhere. It's not enough to simply say we don't want regime change. We must find a way to support democracy here in the United States and around the world. The United States is not unique. Coup attempts like this have happened in other nations. In every instance, it's the same strategy: appeal to bigotry and nationalism. Fascism has been on the rise around the globe. We are only now facing the consequences of American imperialism. In many ways, the United States has been an enemy of democracy. The United States has undermined democracies around the world. Now the threat to democracy has come to us. We should not be surprised that the Republican Party's failure to hold President Trump accountable has led to a brazen attempt to overthrow our democracy. We must shore up the pillars of power as described by the activist group Choose Democracy. So you may have seen this from the if you attended some of the Choose Democracy trainings, and they did the
And so each of these groups, we need to shore up each of these groups, and we can see that in each of these groups, we have problems. Business, I don't know how to get business on our side, but they want democracy. Politicians, we got a huge problem there. Military was on our side, or didn't support Trump. We know we got problems in the media. We got a packed judiciary. We know we got problems in the police. But our government workers have stood strong. I think that they are the heroes of this. Yeah, so business, politicians, the military, the media, the judiciary, police, and bureaucrats are all pillars of power that support the regime. We must work with and make inroads with each of these institutions to ensure their continued support for democracy. Many of these institutions oppose Trump's attack on democracy, and the police lost some of their own. We should thank them and continue to work together to address the widespread dissemination of disinformation at the highest levels. I don't have all the answers, but I have some ideas for reforms that we could do quickly, short of amending the Constitution. The first, of course, is to hold our leaders accountable. We cannot have a system of justice where our leaders are allowed to commit serious federal crimes while Black and Brown people are being killed by police in cities across the nation. Allowing our leaders to get away with crimes leading to death and destruction is the same as letting cops get away with murder. Trump and his cohorts spread disinformation about the election, brought an armed and angry mob to the Capitol, and incited an insurrection. Many of the traitors intended to assault and kill members of Congress. 5 people died as a result, including a police officer and 2 officers who committed suicide afterwards. Those who commit federal crimes should go to jail. The president should not be exempt. The Justice Department must reverse its policy that a sitting president cannot be indicted. The policy elevates the person above the office. No other officials are given such deference. It allows the president to commit crimes with impunity. Some have also called for the reinstatement of the special counsel law, which allows for investigations of the president independent of the Justice Department. Now that the president is out of office, he is subject to arrest. Not only can we arrest Trump, we might want to challenge some of the pardons he issued. Otherwise, we allow the abuse of the pardon power to go unchallenged. At this point, I would challenge the pardon power. Article 2, Section 2 of the Constitution grants the pardon power to the president, except in cases of impeachment. So we have a legal basis to argue that those who participated in the activity for which the president was impeached should not benefit from a pardon. Trump's ability to disseminate disinformation widely became a lethal weapon in his hands. Some media outlets were complicit and actively disseminated this disinformation they knew or should have known was false. Some are even being sued for defamation. We will need a return to journalistic ethics. Social media companies did finally act once they realized the terrible consequences of allowing criminal organizations to communicate and disseminate false and misleading information on their platforms. Other media outlets, however, continued to disseminate disinformation. Journalistic ethics reform could include the creation of a professional organization that could label disinformation or certify reliable news outlets. We might not be able to tell all disinformation, but we can promote reliable news outlets. We should also prosecute large networks like Fox News that disseminate disinformation widely. Social media companies are learning how to address the disinformation, the dissemination of harmful, false, and misleading content without suppressing the free expression of individuals and small publishers. So I've been an advocate of educating the public about propaganda. Media literacy is one way to counter the adverse effects of propaganda. Propaganda is actually any persuasive material, and it includes advertising and political messaging. So there is propaganda on both the left and the right, and in the middle as well. So propaganda, however, can be divisive, misleading, or demoralizing. It's important to be critical about what we choose to think and believe, to make sure that our sources are reliable, because the welfare of human beings and the security of our nation are at stake. We put our nation in the hands of foreign agents and unscrupulous actors when we carelessly believe things without valid evidence or trustworthy sources. We can also pass legislation like House Resolution 1, which expands voting rights, changes campaign finance laws to reduce the influence of money in politics, limits partisan gerrymandering, and creates new ethics rules for federal officers. Even now, Republicans are working to enact restrictions on voting. There are, in fact, many legislative and legal avenues we can pursue to protect our right to vote, and hopefully Bill and Alan will address some of these. Finally, we must reach out to the center of the nation. Not only must we shore up the pillars of power, we must bring the American people along with us. Impeachment and accountability are a part of that process. This is why I think it's important to support the Truth Commission proposed by Nancy Pelosi. There is no reconciliation without truth, and no truth without accountability. We should also monitor our rhetoric and avoid the use of divisive labels. I mean, I think there is a fascist threat on the extremists, but we should be judicious in using words like fascist, socialist, especially Christian Nazi, except to characterize extremists. Instead, we have to find common ground with the middle of the country. So our common support for democracy is something we share. Even those who attacked the Capitol justified it by saying the election was stolen. Scripture can also be used to reach out to fellow Americans. In many ways, we share the American dream of family, community, and security. We should focus on policies that benefit people rather than ideology, religion, or identity. And these are just a few ways to find common ground. So the collapse of democracy is, of course, not the only challenge facing America. Better to foresee the challenges we face and prepare ourselves to meet them than to splinter over priorities or ideology. Certainly, systemic injustice, the COVID pandemic, healthcare, and the environment are crises that must be met quickly. And there are many things we can do to protect democracy. The world needs a pro-democracy movement in America. So I would like to make this a monthly meeting on Saturday. I'd like to form a coalition of like-minded people and groups to work to promote democracy and truth. And speaking of action, we have with us Alan Minsky, the executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, and author, attorney, and journalist Bill Blum. Alan worked as a progressive journalist for the past two decades and was program director of KPFK Los Angeles from 2009 to 2018, where he coordinated Pacifica Radio's national coverage of elections. He currently leads Progressive Democrats of America, a group of which I'm a member. And Bill Blum is a former judge and death penalty defense attorney. His work has appeared in multiple publications, and he's been covering the Trump administration's threat to democracy for at least as long as I have, since the Mueller report came out. So my name is Rich Proceda. I'm an author, attorney, and journalist. And I host and produce a news and politics podcast called Bible Study for Progressives, which this is a live recording. And I'm also working with Progressive Democrats of America on a East Los Angeles County area chapter. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Alan.
Well, thank you very much, Rich. And I'm very honored to be here. I'm going to be brief in part because I was anticipating that Bill would go before me, but I do want to throw out a few volleys and then maybe, as it were, reserve my time to add after Bill speaks as well. I do want to start out with this, however. This morning and early afternoon has been the most difficult time I've faced since I've been executive director of Progressive Democrats of America, one of our really two primary co-founders of the organization, died suddenly yesterday, Steve Cobble. He was our political director. Steve was a McGovern delegate in 72, was a top aide to Jesse Jackson, worked on the 84 campaign, became a top aide with Jackson for the 88 campaign. And for people who are unfamiliar with Progressive Democrats of America, we are the organization that drafted Bernie Sanders to run for president in 2016. We started our campaign as early as 2013, really got it off the ground, Run Bernie Run in 2014. And for a full year, we were the only national organization calling on Senator Sanders to run and to run as a Democrat. And Steve Cobble really was the architect of that as well. I was in contact with Steve on Thursday and to set up a meeting for this morning. He was his usual charming and upbeat self on Thursday, and he died suddenly yesterday. I don't know the cause of death yet. We obviously spoke about January 6th, Steve Cobble and I, and we at PDA obviously watched what happened and have been tracking now since the founding of our organization, the fragility of American democracy. And it's fragile. I actually just sort of want to offer up some very broad stroke thoughts and then maybe comment more on the detail if I can reserve my time after Bill goes. You know, the United States of America has always had an extremely flawed variation of democracy for the obvious reasons that we all know. A democratic society with our Declaration of Independence and our Constitution existing simultaneously with chattel slavery and an ongoing genocide of the indigenous people of the continent, let alone even the fact that women weren't allowed initially, well, not allowed to vote until 1920. However, we had the Constitution, we had the Declaration of Independence, and we had inscribed in the American social contract a rejection of monarchy, support for a constitution, and the establishment of a democratic republic. If you look at human history, democracies are few and far between, extremely few and far between. And when they do come up, their fragility appears. I mean, again, in recorded history, and obviously the history that I learned growing up was widely Eurocentric, broadly Eurocentric. But still, democracies, especially along the line of a constitutional Republican democracy, they're rare. And again, when they have occurred, they've proven fragile and they've gone away. And then the United States of America, for all sorts of various reasons, does also rise as a global power to become the military, economic, and cultural hegemon in the world. Again, with a constitutional democratic republic, extremely flawed in the ways that we know. And the flaws I'll get back to in a second, because they're so central to the history of America as well. And obviously then the Cold War takes place. You get to, I'm forgetting the name of the chap who declared the end of history in the late 1980s and early 90s.
Francis Fukuyama.
Thank you, of course, Francis Fukuyama. And you get to the collapse of the Soviet Union and we're gonna have liberal capitalism and constitutional Republican liberal capitalism all across the globe. Fast forward a few decades from that, and boy, the fragility of democracy is apparent all over the world, the rise of right-wing ethno-nationalism. And I think the era of the, you know, there is no alternative through to the end of history. End of history, second half of that goes from what, 1990 only till about 2008-09, because it's sort of easy to see the fragility of global democracies and liberal democracies start to come into play with the collapse of the financial markets, the Great Recession, the rise of ethno-nationalism in Western Europe. We have people like Modi, Bolsonaro, Duterte all across the world. We see the satellite countries that were no longer dictatorships coming off of the Cold War that were American satellites start to lose their, the becoming more democratic and start to revert back to less democracy. Brexit somehow fits into this logic, though. It's a bit of an uneasy fit. Donald Trump, not an uneasy fit, but all following what Rich said again. Not only that, by 2016, we could say Bolsonaro, the Eastern European dictators, Vladimir Putin should be mentioned in this too, because the episode of democracy in the former Soviet Union, not just Eastern Europe, European countries, corrodes very rapidly and consolidates into something less than anything resembling a liberal constitutional democratic republic. Okay, Duterte, Bolsonaro, all the names I checked before, Donald Trump really becomes the leading figurehead of this movement internationally. And in that sense, there's a logic to Brexit that fits in there as well. And you have, you know, Salvini in Italy, you have the Le Pens in France, and in almost every Western European country too, similar types of characters from the rising anti-democratic, ethno-nationalist, more authoritarian far right. And then informing this too, however, is something where the Democratic Party's relationship to becomes a less easy fit and is less clearly a protagonist. And we in Progressive Democrats of America and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party really do address this component very directly, which by which I mean, okay, why are democracies pulling apart across the world? What's their relationship to the massive degrees of wealth inequality that exist, not just in Western democracies, but across the world? I mean, when you have this level of wealth inequality, and in the United States, when you have something like Citizens United on top of it, you have economic and political power increasingly concentrated into the hands of the few, and that lends itself to oligarchy, not to democracy. This level of wealth inequality and political inequality and democracy are like oil and water. And unfortunately, the Clintonite Democratic Party had policies which did not counter this tendency towards wealth inequality, in fact, largely exacerbated it. We had a Democratic Party that was covetous of some of the main drivers of this, which include Wall Street and Silicon Valley, which also conspicuously, if you look at the map of the United States, are located in the Northeast and in California. And the wealth generated in the country is concentrated there. And you then see at least some semblance of sense as to why the Democratic Party then gets rejected in the middle of the country, even more than the Republican Party. And in the middle of the country, the generally the political class in general is despised. Not very popular on either coast either. Now, the Democratic Party has to become a pro-democracy party. It has to right now double down and force support for H.R. 1. We as progressives, I feel, need, and Rich mentioned this, I think this is a hugely, hugely, hugely important bill. Is it absolutely perfect in the way we would want it to be? No, but it's damn good. The Republican Party is an anti-small d Democratic Party at this point, and we see it even after the elections, as it is doubling down in state legislatures with further attacks on civil rights and on the Voting Rights Act, advancing gerrymandering, and everything that can be done in a targeted way to limit access to the ballot box for people who will not vote Republican, to pervert the system in the ways that H.R. 1 addresses directly. But here we are. H.R. 1 is no way, it doesn't qualify. It's not a question of the interpretation of a Senate parliamentarian. We know it cannot be put into a reconciliation bill. It requires the elimination of the filibuster because we know the Republican Party is 100%. Lisa Murkowski would be voted out of the party in a second if she dared to swing over and provide a vote for S1 or Senate 1. Anyway, you'd need 60. You would need 10 Republicans to break to something that Mitch McConnell would force. Okay. But to break the filibuster, you need 50 votes. And every Democrat and every progressive needs to convey to every Democrat that Kyrsten Sinema, Joe Manchin must support the breaking of the filibuster because we must pass H.R. 1 and S1. Just like we must pass immigration reform, we must pass the PRO Act, we must pass the Equality Act, we must pass gun legislation, none of which are passable unless the filibuster is eliminated right now. Obviously, there's other political points to be made, which is that the public's going to be pretty damn disappointed with the Democratic Party if it doesn't achieve any of these things. And that means they're going to do worse in 2022. But that's a secondary thought. Let's just deal with it really in the way that Rich beautifully framed things around a politics, really, of what is yes, right, and wrong. And I'll end with this. And I don't need time after, Bill, because I think I've taken up my time. I'll put myself in the queue after this. I'm dying to hear what Bill Blum has to say. But the United States of America right now is at a crossroads. Yes, the history of democracy in this country is insanely flawed. But we now know, as progressives and just good-hearted people in the 21st century, what we have to do. We need to directly address structural racism and its rootedness in American society in all of our forms. And that means, among other things, the absolute commitment to establishing a model, and truly a model, constitutional democratic republic with stronger democracy in this country. And if we do this, the United States may not be as much at the center of global culture, economics, and everything as it was a while ago. It still is. We are the most ethnically diverse country in the history of the world. For all of the problems of our history that we all know, we arrive at this point now and at this hour with a capacity as a country uniquely positioned in global history to stake a claim for democracy and for anti-racism. And I think it is really incumbent upon all of us to put all of our hearts and souls into that effort. So thank you. I really appreciate being here with all of you.
Thank you very much. All right, great. So I introduced him earlier. Here he is.
Great to be here. For those of you who don't know me, I'll just give a little bit of additional background. I'm a retired administrative law judge, former California State Public Defender, former deputy in the Department of Justice. Currently, I'm a lecturer at the USC Annenberg School, and I write a syndicated column on law and politics, which is syndicated by the Independent Media Institute. Used to be a full-time, regular columnist with Truthdig when it was publishing. I've been writing about Donald Trump and the dangers that he poses to democracy since 2015, almost before anyone else was really trying to promote the idea that he is a unique threat, or was a unique threat, a continuing threat to American democracy. My first columns dealt with his war on anchor babies. I don't know if you recall the early days of the 2016 campaign when Donald Trump wanted to reinterpret the 14th Amendment and end birthright citizenship. And from there, I moved on to dealing with Donald Trump's war on the First Amendment and his call to overturn New York Times versus Sullivan, which gives people, writers, public advocates, the right to criticize public officials without fear of incurring crippling defamation lawsuit costs. I was among the first to predict that Donald Trump would be impeached. This is before he was inaugurated in January 2017, and set forth the reasons why. Also, one of the first to profile Donald Trump based on my discussions with mental health experts as a malignant narcissist in a column for Truthdig, which was picked up by many outlets. And then one of the first to say quite candidly, and this is a little different from Rich's take, because I didn't put the same kind of emotion on the word fascism that most people do, but I wrote a few articles dealing with the history of fascism, dealing with the definitions, the basic definitions offered by people like Robert Paxson, Umberto Eco, traditional Marxism, that Donald Trump was indeed a fascist. America wasn't fascist, but that Donald Trump was the leader of a neo-fascist movement. And we had to be particularly on guard for the threat that that movement posed to all the values that we hold near and dear. Which brings me to what happened on January 6th. What happened on January 6th was, as Rich stated, an attempted coup. But it wasn't a haphazard attempt, as many in the media portray it, or an inept attempt. It was actually fairly sophisticated, and it operated on many different levels. There were really 9 steps behind this coup attempt. And to understand it, you have to go back at least to the 2013 decision of the U.S. Supreme Court in Shelby County versus Holder, which guts the Voting Rights Act. America has always been a nation of voter suppression. If you look at the early history of the Republic, the only people who could vote were white Christian men of property. And after that, there's been a struggle for more inclusivity. But we took a giant step backwards as a country in 2013. Okay, so in 2013, we gut the Voting Rights Act, which opens the door to all sorts of suppression techniques that Trump and his people intended to take advantage of in 2020. Gerrymandering, closing of polls, voter ID, et cetera, and so forth. The second step towards this coup d'etat was disinformation, was the message that Trump pumped out that either he would win or there would be fraud or there would be a steal. The third level, which started in 2017, was an attempt to pack the federal courts and particularly the Supreme Court with conservative justices who, in Trump's mind, would protect him from all the kinds of civil and criminal liability that he might otherwise incur. The fourth step after the election results, Trump claimed victory. We all saw him on the night or the early morning hours of November 4th proclaim victory. We knew that given the way that mail-in voting had been conducted across the country, that there would be a blue surge after the initial red upwelling in the electoral election results. And so you had the rhetoric of stop the steal being promoted. And then that was followed by a fifth step, lawsuits, 62 of them, all the way to the Supreme Court. That was accompanied by pressure put on the states to reverse their own election results. We saw that particularly in Georgia, but we saw it all over the country, in Michigan and elsewhere. When Rudy Giuliani went to talk to the state legislatures and Trump had Republicans from Michigan come to the Oval Office. We had the seventh step, which was the pressure put on Pence aimed at January 6th, which is when, in joint session, the legislature and the vice president count the electoral votes. And then we had the insurrection on January 6th itself. That insurrection, legally speaking, was aimed at the 12th Amendment. I wonder if everybody realizes that. Because the 12th Amendment, together with the Electoral Count Act of 1887, really determined how we count the electoral votes. And the strategy all along was that if all these other steps failed and the electoral votes could not be counted in a definitive way, then the election would be put in the hands of the House of Representatives, where each state delegation got one vote, not where every member got one vote. And because Republican delegations outnumbered Democratic delegations, the election would be handed to Donald Trump. So this really was a fairly well thought out plan to overthrow the government of the United States. And it resulted, predictably, and this was good, in an impeachment resolution. The impeachment resolution, as a matter of law, and impeachment's really a hybrid of law and politics, we knew it would fail because the Republican Party, those of us who grew up on Watergate, we had some hope that the Republican Party was somehow salvageable and that the Senate would redeem itself and vote to convict Donald Trump. Most of us, though, knew that that wouldn't happen. However, we got 57 votes for conviction. But a few things going forward, if we're going to look at impeachment as any kind of sound remedy that we ought to pursue to maintain democracy in the United States, is that certain minor changes can be made to the Senate rules, but that constitutionally, the sole power to try impeachments resides with the Senate. And if the Senate's corrupt, there's no way you're going to get anything other than a corrupt verdict from the Senate. But certain things could be done, such as we could have an amendment to the Senate rules which says that pretrial motions, once decided, are binding on the senators in terms of their vote on the merits. What does that mean in practice? Well, the big pretrial motion was whether or not you could try a former official, a former president, in an impeachment case before the Senate. The Senate voted that, yes, you can. So now that becomes what we call the law of the case. And yet we know from post-trial interviews that many senators voted to acquit, claiming that they thought the whole proceeding was unconstitutional. So that could be changed. Another thing that could be changed is that the senators would be precluded upon penalty of fines from conferring with the lawyers for one side or the other. That was done repeatedly by the Republicans during the impeachment trial. We could also require them to remain in the Senate chamber for the entire presentation. We could also amend the Senate rules to allow for, to make it required, to have witnesses testify on the Senate floor. We haven't seen that in a long, long time in an impeachment trial. Under the current Senate rules, the gathering of evidence, when it takes place by committee, and they conduct depositions, and then they'll come back and play excerpts of those depositions at the impeachment trial. Nonetheless, despite all of those shortcomings, I thought the House impeachment managers did a very good job, and that the record that they compiled will be useful going forward for organizing purposes and also for purposes of the 2022 elections and the 2024 elections. I also want to point out that it's not the House managers who dropped the ball on witnesses. What the Senate voted on that Saturday morning was to allow debate on the consideration of witnesses. So I don't think that the House managers really are the ones who dropped the ball on that. Which leads me to the other topic that I write a lot about, because I write about the intersection of law and politics, which is, are we going to see a prosecution, a criminal prosecution of Donald Trump? I have my doubts that we're going to see one federally, although Donald Trump deserves to be prosecuted. That will be up to the Biden Justice Department without interference from Biden himself, as he's told us. And I'm not confident that Merrick Garland will do that, although I think that the best chance we have for prosecuting Trump federally is through the Southern District of New York. You know, he was already named as individual number one in the Michael Cohen case involving the effort to pay hush money to Stormy Daniels and Karen McDougal, which violated federal election law. And that is a possibility, and I think we should keep that in mind. But the most promising avenue for bringing Donald Trump to criminal justice right now lies in New York. And the Supreme Court just last week, and I wrote an article about this, which has been syndicated pretty widely, denied finally an emergency petition filed by Trump's attorneys in October to stay lower court orders requiring Trump's longtime accounting firm to turn over his tax records and other financial documents to the Manhattan District Attorney. So that is happening right now. That investigation's been going on since 2018. Think of it as similar to what brought down Al Capone. It wasn't Al Capone killing people that got him sent to prison. It was income tax evasion. So I think that Trump's greatest liability criminally right now is under New York law for things like business fraud, tax fraud, bank fraud. And I think there is a strong likelihood that there will be an indictment filed against him. Other points more broadly that Alan touched on, the filibuster, absolutely something that has to go, but there isn't enough support to change the Senate rules on that question right now. Right now, You need 60 votes for most pieces of legislation to have cloture, which means an end of debate. There's a way to get around that. We saw that with the appointment of Supreme Court justices and lower court justices. It's called the nuclear option, and you can do that by amending Senate rules with a bare majority. But we don't even have that at this point. So that's one thing that needs to be done. Another thing that needs to be done, in my view, is to support this interstate compact to change the Electoral College. And that's an agreement among states whereby they would put their electoral votes behind the candidate that receives the most popular votes nationally. I think that that legally is a strategy that could work, but right now there are only enough states to comprise 196 electoral votes. Two other things that I think should be on the agenda of progressives are statehood for DC and Puerto Rico. Each of those measures is possible with majority support in both houses. And now's the time to move on those two matters. They would change the balance of power in the United States and make it more reflective of the actual population and of the political views of the population. Don't forget, when the founders created this country, among all the various mistakes they made, was they created an upper chamber. This is the chamber that tries impeachment, that has two senators per state, regardless of population. So you have a very undemocratic balance of power in the Senate. Having DC and Puerto Rico as states would alter that. So those are just some of the measures that I think people ought to think about. And as we go forward, it's important to try to do a number of these things, and there'll be different people working on different projects. But I do think it's really important to emphasize that we do face, in the United States and across the globe, a growing and very strong, determined, and entrenched right-wing autocratic movement that isn't going away. And even if Donald Trump becomes too old or too tied up with litigation not to lead that movement, the movement's not going to die with Donald Trump. So this is not something that we can put on the shelf and think, okay, Trump's no longer president, so let's take it easy. It's something that we have to be constantly vigilant about. How we do it, through what sorts of reforms, well, that's up to other people beyond me. But one of the things that I always emphasize is that this fight isn't over. We're still in the early rounds, and all of us have to realize that and stay strong, stay healthy, not get exhausted by the battle, and continue. So with that, I'll end.
Thank you. Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Mr. Blum.
This has been Bible Study for Progressives. If you enjoyed the program, please subscribe to our podcast or put us in your favorites and write a 5-star review. Tell your friends about us and share us on social media. Follow us on Facebook and click the donate button at modernlectionaries.blogspot.com. Your support will help us reach more people, produce more and better shows, and cover the cost of production. Feel free to send me a note or comment on the show. I would love to hear from you. Until next time, this is Rich Procida. Thank you for listening.